This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The idea is that you and I get briefed together on the important questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. If it works for you or if it doesn't, please let us know what you think by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider. Turkey has been in the headlines in the last few days. A very public row with the United States has exposed its economic frailty. So this week we're asking how significant this crisis is.
Yastığınızın altında dolarlar varsa...
If you have dollars under your pillow, take them out. If you have euros, take them out. If you have gold, take it out. I'm talking to those who have them. Immediately give them to the banks and convert them into Turkish lira. And by doing this, we can fight this war of independence and for the future.
That was Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan this week rather dramatically trying to halt a currency crisis for the Turkish lira, which has lost more than 30% of its value against the dollar this year. What's gone wrong for Turkey, which not so long ago was a fast-growth economy? Can it be solved by raiding the mattress? And politically, if President Erdogan thinks he's fighting a war of independence and a war for the future, who is he fighting it against? And what does it mean for the rest of us? Step into the briefing room and we'll find out. First, we're going to hear a little about the man himself. Because few global leaders today, it seems, have accumulated as much personal power as President Erdogan. Here's Soner Çağatay, whose biography of the president is entitled The New Sultan.
Understanding Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan goes through understanding his upbringing in what used to be a secularist society in Turkey that shunned people like Erdogan and his family, conservative Turks, who wanted to wear religion on their sleeve. This was a society shaped after Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, which envisioned Turkey as a secular society in which there would be no religion in public space, education, or government. Erdogan was born in 1954 to a working-class family in a gritty Istanbul neighborhood. He feels that he is the guy from the other side of the tracks, politically and economically, and although today he is the most powerful Turkish politician, oftentimes, I think, Erdogan remains the guy from the other side of the tracks. Erdogan broke his teeth into politics in the 1970s in Turkey's movement of political Islam. Unlike today, where the tensions in Turkey are often about religion and secularism or the role of religion in society, the conflict that roiled Turkey was between communists and leftists and right-wings and nationalist people. And for Erdogan, both represented the snake oil of the West. And I think this is where the roots of Erdogan's nativism lie. He sees only himself, his political movement, and his followers as true Turks and true Muslims, and all other people who subscribe to other ideas, ideologies, or support other political parties as tainted by foreign ideas. In 2001, Turkey had its worst economic crisis to date. Erdogan had set up a new movement and called it Justice and Development Party, AKP. And he was saying that the AKP was not an Islamist party. It was a conservative democratic force. And so the electorate decided to give Erdogan a chance. Erdogan is a master politician, a master of branding. He decided to call his party Justice and Development Party. But in Turkey's initials, the party is known usually as AK Party or AK Party. The word AK, AK in Turkish, means something that is white in the abstract sense. This was Erdogan's message to Turkish electorate, sick and tired of corruption, that his party was clean and not corrupt.
At the age of 49, Tayyip Erdogan is on his way to the prime minister's office. Last November's general election victory by the party he leads was very much his victory. He is a charismatic politician who inspired...
When Erdogan came to power, initially he embraced democracy because at that time his popular support was weak. He built popular support through delivering economic growth. The more popular he became, the more Erdogan moved away from his promise to be a moderate political force. And in the 2007 elections, Erdogan's party's votes jumped up from 34% in 2002 to nearly 46%, nearly half of the electorate.
Perhaps no bouquet could be big enough to celebrate this stunning victory. It's rare for a ruling party to actually increase its vote. And last night, they celebrated in style. The prime minister arrived with his head...
I would say by the time he was close to having near majority support in Turkish society, Erdogan had forgotten the reasons that he had moderated. I would say there are two aspects of Erdogan's consolidation of power and expansion of presidential power. The first has to do with his view of Turkish political system, specifically the system that dealt him a bad hand in the 1990s when the military stepped in to force out a party rooted in political Islam from government. Erdogan's lesson from this experience was that when he came to power, he'd be very methodical. He would not go after all his adversaries at the same time. He would go after them one by one. He started with the military, alleging that there was a coup plot to oust him. The prosecutors never produced full and convincing account of the said coup, but Erdogan nevertheless used the allegations of coup plot to arrest nearly a quarter of active duty admirals and generals. And this is when the secularist military bowed to Erdogan and exited politics. He changed the constitution by amendment, allowing himself to appoint a majority of judges to the high courts. So this effectively erased separation of powers between the judiciary and the executive branch. He went after the media that had been critical of parties of political Islam. Today, many people who hear about Gulen movement, which was once an Erdogan ally, would not know the role the movement played in helping Erdogan consolidate power. This movement, led by Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the United States, was an Erdogan ally when Erdogan went after the military, the media, the courts, and his secularist opponents. Gulen movement had a vast network of sympathizers and followers in the Turkish police, judiciary, and media, and those helped Erdogan build the court case, which was used to intimidate the military, lock up dissidents, and effectively create the Republic of Fear. To use an analogy, Erdogan is like the doner kebab master, taking slices from Turkish democracy ever so thin with the meticulous precision of a doner kebab master who takes such thin slices from the spit that you don't see the spit getting smaller. That's what he did to Turkish democracy. If you sat and watched, you saw it getting smaller. If you took occasional snapshots, it looked good and healthy and large enough. That doner kebab master that Erdogan was left politics in 2016. The night of the coup was one of the most fateful nights of Erdogan's life. A team of assassins descended on the resort hotel where he was staying. The coup plotters almost got to Erdogan, but yet Erdogan's life-changing incident was when he went on his smartphone, broadcast an interview to millions of his followers. He asked them to take to the streets and to defend democracy. Millions of people came out to the streets to block coup plotters. And he asked his followers not only to go and support him, but also the 80,000 mosques in Turkey to start broadcasting the call for prayer in the middle of the night. Now, in the Muslim tradition, the call for the prayer goes out five times a day. There are set times for it. When it comes out outside of the set time, it's completely unexpected. I would say, if political Islam was one part of Erdogan's identity and political legacy until the night of the coup, it probably became the dominant part of his identity after the coup, because it was the appeal to Islam and the political Islamist base that pretty much saved Erdogan. Soon after, Erdogan started to use the new powers given to him, such as state of emergency, to crack down not only alleged and actual coup plotters, but also the broader opposition. Erdogan has realized that to continue winning elections, he needs to become increasingly more authoritarian in order not to give his opposition a chance to vote him out. He recently won a constitutional referendum, which gave him executive-style powers. Again, of course, this referendum was fought in the aftermath of an unfair campaign, and he also won elections soon after in June this year to become an elected president, finally assuming these wide executive powers given to him. He is now head of state, head of government, head of ruling party, head of the police, head of the army. In other words, he has become Turkey's new sultan.
Soner Çaptay. So we've heard that President Erdogan is now in charge of almost everything, and that includes the economy. The currency crisis is the current headline, but what lies beneath that? Joining me now in the briefing room is Dr. Mida Toksurs from the foreign affairs think tank Chatham House. She's an expert in emerging markets. Mida Toksurs, to what extent do you think that President Erdogan is himself to blame for Turkey's economic problems?
Most people tend to just focus on what, you know, he last said and the fact that, you know, certain things are triggered by what his statements and so on. But I think you really do have to look at the underlying structural factors, which is that since the global financial crisis, Turkey has been hit by multiple economic shocks. So there was a crisis, then there was the Eurozone sovereign debt crisis, which, you know, Turkey exports, half its exports go to Europe. So that was a major problem. And then 2013, there was a tapering shock where a huge amount of capital flowed out of the country. And then came the Syrian crisis. And then came the failed coup in 2016. And this is where Erdogan's personal particular policies come in. He wanted to change the Turkish constitution to a presidential system, so he had to win that constitutional reform. So then the economy went into a permanent election economy mode for the past couple of years. And so huge amount of imbalances have been built up.
So what happens when you go into permanent election mode in terms of economic policies? You do, presumably you're saying you do things to please the electorate you wouldn't otherwise do.
Exactly. So it became a question of how do you maintain growth despite the fact that the global economic environment is deteriorating and suggesting that Turkey needs to rein back growth a bit, be careful about how much foreign currency borrowing they're doing, keep their current account deficit under control, etc. So instead of doing that, they just stimulated, and in order to overcome the shock of the failed coup, again, massive fiscal and credit stimulus. And so what we have is completely expected, which is accelerating inflation, double digits now, and a current account deficit that has been growing very rapidly.
Now, in an economy such as Britain's, one of the reasons why we gave independence to the Bank of England was so that somebody who was a bit of an expert would say, no, you don't want to do this, and we have some powers to try and make sure that you don't. What's happened in Turkey to those independent sources of economic expertise and power?
Central bank independence is one of those red lines, really, for especially international bond market traders and investors, which Turkey depends on for financing a lot of its investment, because one of the problems, structural problems of Turkey is a very low savings, domestic savings. So in order to grow and invest, it's dependent on external inflows of some kind. So central bank independence was one thing that everyone was very keen on. And in the first sort of 5-6 years of AK Party rule, you had a situation where interest rates and inflation was falling. So this was never an issue. But once global economy turned and international interest rates began to rise, in Turkey, they failed to respond time and again. And so the credibility of the central bank was hugely weakened. Now, Erdogan has been an AK Party periphery as well, have had this thing about interest rates, which has, you know, has an Islamic thing. But, you know, there's also the populist side of it, which is he states all the time, his big target is something called the interest rate lobby, which is international investors, but also domestic, sort of upper middle class and financial sector, which, you know, make quite a lot of money from trading and so on. So he also has this populist thing, sort of where he sides with the people against those who don't care about the hardship of the people.
Is there an interest rate lobby? Is there such a thing?
Not in a coherent political sense, of course not. But what there is people who sort of trying to explain how what are the laws of the market and how markets work.
Does that mean that he's also edged out independent advice within the economy? I mean, we know, for instance, that his son-in-law is now Minister of Finance. You can't imagine, for instance, a situation whereby they would have a big disagreement and fall out.
It's a bit unfortunate that he has appointed Berat Albayrak. Berat Albayrak is generally quite correct in the way that he is approaching the economy and the sort of things that he's been saying. And he's been most recently working on a medium-term program to rebalance the Turkish economy away from dependence on capital inflows and increased savings.
But how can you both do that and also characterize the interest rate lobby as being your enemy?
Well, that's Erdogan speaking in rallies in Anatolia. Now, the big mistake he made was he came to London in May, and this is a precursor of the current currency crisis, and held a meeting with international investors and said to them, I'm going to take charge of monetary policy when I'm re-elected. And international investors were hugely alarmed by this, not surprisingly, and withdrew, you know, billions of dollars. So I think that there is a risk there that because he's centralized authorities so much, he doesn't have people who are able to tell him, look, that's not the sort of thing you do.
Now, how much of the recent economic crisis is down to the arguments with America?
It's triggered the recent crisis in particular, and it's led to a deterioration of sentiment, investor sentiment towards Turkey. But the underlying issues are the fact that Turkish economic policy has been very slow to respond to deteriorating global conditions. So, you know, I think we shouldn't overestimate it. However, having got to where we are now, I think a fundamental sustainable stabilization will require not just economic measures, but some kind of improvement in relations with the US.
Dr. Mina Toksas. So for Turkey to contain this crisis, it would be a good idea to get on better with the United States. But right now, the opposite seems to be happening. How advanced is this process? And is Turkey's historic position as a member of the Western alliance about to change? I'm joined now in the briefing room by two experts, Dr. Amanda Sloat from the Brookings Institution, she's in Washington, D.C., and Dr. Zia Meral, who's a specialist on Turkey and a fellow at the British Army's Centre for Historical Analysis and Conflict Research. He's here in London. Amanda Sloat, what is actually going on between Turkey and the United States at the moment?
Well, I think there's a history of grievances between the two countries that have been accumulating over the last couple of years. From the Turkish perspective, there's a sense that the U.S. has failed to take seriously its security concerns in terms of continuing to house Islamic cleric Fethullah Gulen, who the Turks see as being responsible for the coup attempt, and cooperating with a faction of Kurds in Syria in the fight against the Islamic State, given their affiliation with the PKK, a domestic terrorist organization in Turkey. From the American perspective, there's been a lot of questions about whether or not Turkey is a reliable ally, given their desire to purchase Russian defense equipment and also their engagement in hostage diplomacy by holding Americans as well as Turkish employees of U.S. consulates. And it's that latter issue that really has brought the current crisis to a head, with a particular focus on Pastor Andrew Brunson, who has been held in Turkey for nearly 2 years on charges that the American side considers spurious.
And so what actions have the Americans actually taken in order to put pressure on the Turks?
So over the last year, the U.S. administration tried a diplomatic approach. Secretary Tillerson was in Turkey in February, and that led to the creation of several working groups, one of which was dealing with judicial issues. Two senators met with Erdogan this summer to try and press their case directly. And what we have seen in the last couple of weeks is growing frustration that the diplomatic efforts have not worked, and so a turn to putting economic pressure on them. The first thing that happened about a week and a half ago was that the U.S. used Magnitsky sanctions, which were initially developed to deal with human rights abuses in Russia. The U.S. imposed those sanctions, which are essentially asset freezes, onto Turkish ministers. Turkey then retaliated. What we saw last Friday was the U.S. imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum in Turkey, with similar economic retaliation by the Turks. And there seems to be a willingness on the U.S. part to continue increasing economic pressure on Turkey until they achieve their goal of seeing Pastor Andrew Brunson back on American soil.
So why don't the Turks just release him?
That's a good question, and certainly one that's occupying a lot of minds here in Washington. Certainly the sense is that Erdogan does not want to be seen as being bullied by the Americans. And there also is a sense that Erdogan is trying to negotiate a deal. Everybody saw the fist bump between Trump and Erdogan on the margins of the NATO summit, which seemed to indicate that some sort of agreement had been reached. Whatever understanding there seems to have been between the two men, it seems to have broken down and gone wrong somehow. And so the question now seems to be how much economic pain Erdogan is prepared to withstand, and also whether there's a way of getting this dispute back into diplomatic channels so that we can find a way to resolve this crisis that results in Brunson and ideally the others being freed without further damage being done to the Turkish economy.
Ziya Meral, Erdogan has gone into print in the New York Times, no less, saying that he might be required, if things don't kind of improve, to look for new friends and allies. Does this bring Turkey's continuing membership of NATO into any question?
Yes and no, for various reasons. I mean, the significance of NATO for Turkey has not dwindled at all. In fact, in the last NATO gathering, Erdogan was actually quite proactive, committing more troops and more investments and more participation in NATO. That's because even though Russia and Iran and others have geopolitical and geoeconomic and energy relations makes them important for Turkey, there are still limitations towards them and vulnerabilities. So Turkey sees NATO as an important asset. Yet at the same time, I think there is definitely a crisis of trust between particular countries that make NATO and NATO alliance, and chiefly the tension between US and Turkey. But of course, what Turkey does in some of these critical issues, such as purchase of the Russian missile systems, how it handles participation in other NATO operations and vulnerabilities, that would be an important signal from now on.
So I suppose what I'm asking is, could Turkey effectively talk itself out of NATO, despite the fact that it feels itself to be an important part of that alliance?
Not really. At the moment, nobody in Ankara isn't even entertaining that possibility. Legally, there is no way of kicking a NATO member state out of the alliance, so it has to be a decision given by that country. And all the signs are at the moment, it's not even a possibility debated in Ankara for the reasons that I just mentioned.
So it's going to be the case, Amanda Slope, that whoever the new friends are, they're not going to replace NATO as a form of military alliance.
No, I think Turkey certainly sees its military perspective being best protected within the NATO alliance. Erdogan certainly has made a lot of noise in recent days, including the op-ed that you mentioned in terms of looking at other friends. But when you consider the other possible friends that they might have, there's really three possibilities. One is Qatar, and we saw yesterday them providing $15 billion in investment into Turkey, which seems to have staved off some of the immediate economic collapse. But there certainly is no broader military alliance there. The second possibility is Iran, and Turkey is quite dependent on Iran for its energy resources. And this is going to be another potential flashpoint with the United States in the coming months if Trump goes forward with plans to force all countries to completely eliminate their energy imports from Iran. And the third country is Russia. And Turkey has had a very complicated relationship with Russia. It is another source of energy for Turkey. It's a source of economic investment. So there's the potential of getting some funding there. But relationships with Russia are complicated and come with strings. It was only 3 years ago that there was a major spat between the two countries when Turkey shot down a Russian jet that violated its airspace, leading Putin to slap economic sanctions on Turkey, causing Erdogan to have to apologize. And in Syria, we have a potential major military battle happening in the city of Idlib, which is going to reinforce the fact that Turkey and Russia are on opposite sides of the conflict in Syria. So all of Turkey's other relationships come with their own complications.
So, Zia Murad, that suggests that actually this claim by Erdogan in the New York Times is actually rather empty.
It is empty, but also if you think about the address of that claim, which is President Trump, he's pursuing a rather insular policy and severing a lot of relations. So it's not the kind of threat actually that would work with him, because he himself is not necessarily somebody that seeks alliances beyond the oceans anyway.
Are you saying Erdogan's threat might have worked with somebody like Obama, but it's not going to work with somebody
possibly,
like Trump?
Possibly, but even Obama was ambiguous in some of these alliances. So I think definitely that threat by Erdogan is misplaced. And it's also self-harming as well, too. Turkey is stuck in a very difficult region. I mean, the only solution would be to cut the country out and move it to the Caribbean to really ease some of these tensions. And it's unlikely for that to happen. So in that way, Turkey definitely has to engage with Russia, has to engage with Iran, but also needs NATO, but also needs the United States, but also needs Europe. So how do you go about and handle these extremely complex challenges? That's actually a very difficult diplomatic touchwork, and they're failing at the moment.
Now, it's also presumably a manslaughter. It's rather tricky for us non-US people in NATO and in the European Union, because we don't want to see a worse relationship with Turkey. Turkey's an important country for us, isn't it?
Sure. I mean, one of the main interests that the European countries have in maintaining good relations with Turkey is managing the migration crisis and the large number of Syrian refugee outflows. And if you actually look at what Erdogan has been doing in the last couple of days and weeks, is mending relationships that have been strained with a number of European countries. This week, we saw him release two Greek soldiers that had been held for seemingly just accidentally walking across the land border, which normally they would have been released immediately, but had been held longer and caught up in a drama. They are released. The head of Amnesty International in Turkey, Taner Kilic, who had been in prison for well over a year, was released. He's been mending ties with the Netherlands that have been strained since a disagreement over whether or not Turkish ministers were allowed to campaign there. And he has also been improving relations with Germany. And you've started to see some of these European countries actually come out and defend Turkey against some of these sanctions that the U.S. has been imposing.
Zia Murad, there seems to be a bit of a contradiction here. On the one hand, there's all this kind of mobilization, if you like, of the Turkish population behind nationalistic themes. And then behind it, as soon as it's been mobilized in that way, there's this kind of rowing back pragmatism on the part of the Erdogan administration. Or am I being too optimistic?
No, I think that's true. I mean, some of it is the necessity of domestic politics for Erdogan. When lira is crumbling and the citizens are watching their money melt down, there needs to be a discourse and a rhetoric that gives an explanation and some sort of political rallying behind him. And that worked for him for the last 15 elections or so that he won at historic rates. He knows how to rally his voters behind him. But the problem is it's not sustainable economically. It's not sustainable diplomatically. And I think they see that more than ever within the system and within Ankara itself. But I think Erdogan, he needs to demonstrate this independent Turkey that is assertive, that gets what it wants, achieves respect in international arena. And some of his diplomatic impulses are shaped by that. And it's clearly not going according to the plan. And clearly, limitations to his calls against the United States, for example, is called boycott for a purchase of U.S.-made electronic goods, which is really silly because it's not necessarily really going to harm United States in any shape or form, but he's speaking to his voters.
Zia Miral there and Amanda Sloat. And what I'm taking away from this is that although there is a significant crisis, and it's a crisis both economic and of foreign relations, actually, President Erdogan is sufficiently pragmatic not to take this to any kind of extreme, but will probably row back in order to save both the economy and the Western alliance. Well, my thanks to Sonia Chaptai, Mina Toksurs, Amanda Sloat and Zia Meral. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye. The briefing room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Tom Hill. And please let us know what you think about this programme or the entire series. You can do that by writing a review or rating us on iTunes or your podcast provider, and we really do appreciate hearing from you.
If there was a big red button that would just demolish the internet, I would smash that button with my forehead.
From the BBC, this is The Interface, the show that explores how tech is rewiring your week and your world.
This isn't about quarterly earnings or about tech reviews.
It's about what technology is actually doing to your work, your politics, your everyday life.
And all the bizarre ways people are using the internet.
Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.